Hey, it's Joe. I don't know about you, but for me, time is flying by. When you think back on the last few years, what were your big accomplishments or powerful memories? I think for each of us, the question is, am I living my best life or am I merely passing time, just sustaining my least tolerable life, neither failing nor succeeding in building a life of meaning? What I want to know is, how can I live a big life instead of merely a long one? To answer this question today, I am joined by Adrian Kelly, the author of The Success Complex, in which he explains the nuanced nature of success in life, the path to having a meaningful life in which we can look back with satisfaction in a life well lived. Adrian points out that true fulfillment arises not merely from achievements or the ownership of things or even the level of cumulative pleasure or suffering over time, but from aligning one's actions with a deeper sense of purpose. Adrian presents a framework to help individuals like you and me navigate our unique paths to meaningful success. And it all starts today and is built one day at a time. Carpe diem. All right, let's talk to Adrian Kelly. Adrian Kelly, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Hi, Joe. Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. I've been reading your book, The Success Complex. Very interesting. It resonates with me in a number of different ways, which I'll get into in just a little bit. But for our audience's sake, why don't you tell us who you are? Why'd you write this book?
For sure. So the book, The Success Complex, the title for me anyway, really means complex in the sense of fear of heights or small spaces, a complex in that sense. What's your success complex? What's the blind spot that you can't see that holds you back from what success means to you? And one of the things that the book attempts to do is challenge what society tells us is success and push the reader to reframe and redefine for themselves what success means to them. And I think if I can succeed in at least even asking that question of the reader, I'll be happy. Awesome. So you asked the reason I wrote the book was to bring a lot of information together. I'd be an avid reader myself for a long number of years, particularly in positive psychology and any book I can get my hand on in terms of nonfiction. But I always felt, this might be unfair to say, I always felt that a lot of self-help books had a lot of promise, but didn't quite deliver on that promise. You know, they did a very good premise in terms of what they might challenge or talk about. But the journey that they ultimately bring the reader on doesn't quite bring them somewhere that I would bring them. I'm trying to deliver on that promise and bring the reader to a point where they can feel each chapter is a building block towards something. And the book is divided into three parts. And towards the end, we get to deeper stuff, you know, which we'll probably talk about: purpose, control, transcendence, and the why and what of what we should perhaps pursue. Not to tell anybody what they should do, but some suggestions on maybe things they might like more of in their lives.
Awesome. So this does not sound like new wisdom. It sounds like old, like ancient human wisdom, things that people have known forever, but maybe we're more prone to missing the boat than ever because of our modern institutions.
Well, it's certainly established on very well-grounded research and accepted wisdom. And it's a mix of history. It's a mix of interviews I did with modern day athletes, sports people, chess players, business people, my own personal experiences, and churn all that up together and try and make each chapter as rich and engaging as possible for the reader so that they don't feel like they're being, certainly I hope nobody's ever feel like they're being lectured to in any way, but rather there's a hook there in every chapter where they can, an access point where a point of interest, for example, where they'll be familiar somewhat with the stories. Maybe it's an historical event, maybe it's something different, maybe somebody they know, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, NASA stories, etc., where we said this is the way it is and this is the way it seems, but then we take them on a journey and show them another side of it, of the why it became that way or why it's important. And I enjoy that kind of storytelling, which creates a proposition, then deconstructs it and puts it back together in a different way. And I think that really helps people see a different side of things and also learn something. I want people to feel like they've, you know, each chapter is worth the investment, that the juice is worth the squeeze, as they say.
Right. Yeah. that's useful in that it gives you a way of thinking about it as opposed to what is the answer. You know, what my purpose in life will turn out to be when I figure it out is probably not going to be the same as yours or, you know, anybody else's who I might bump into to talk about this. But needing a purpose in life, that is common to everybody. I think that we can, you know, distract ourselves by, you know, working on our careers and our skills that are marketable and sellable and accumulating wealth and, you know, raising our children and all of this. And it's not unimportant. These are important things as well. But all of this busyness uses up all of our time. And now we don't have time for other things, which are also important. And so we just get out of balance, like the bodybuilder who only works on the upper body and he looks great from the waist up and he's got chicken legs, you know, below the waist. After a while, it's obvious that something's wrong there. And each of us probably knows for ourselves that something is wrong. Something feels hollow. Something, you know, maybe it was the person who had to give up something. You know, they wanted to be a musician, but they went to business school and they've always regretted not having more time to play their music or, you know, whatever it is for them. You know, for me, that kind of resonates in that I always wanted to be an athlete. But, and I was as a young person, but I kind of had to give it up, you know, as I got busy with my trying to become an adult. And I've tried to dabble in it, you know, my whole life and more now, I think, than ever since I was a teenager. And maybe that's why it feels meaningful to me. But, you know, another thing that it gives me is it helps me, it gives me something to orient my efforts to be healthy around.
Yeah. I mean, with any 9-to-5 job, people are trading their time for money. And it's that time you mentioned. What does that trade look like for you? You know, what are you doing for that? Well, leave aside the money. You know, we can earn money a lot of ways, but how do you spend your time? And is it a meaningful way? And, you put it in interesting language there where you say people might find a sense that something's wrong. And maybe that something wrong is a lack of purpose, a lack of overarching meaning in their lives. And sometimes I ask people, I say, what's the difference between purpose and meaning to you? And that, you know, there's always a pause. And for me, meaning is the gravitational pull of purpose. It's what's more important to you. And reassessing that gravitational weight of why do one thing as opposed to another is a very important reevaluation and recalibration we should all be doing continually, because that's the way we it's our guide, our connection with ourselves, you know.
Yeah, I think people know what meaning is when they feel it, even if they can't describe it in a vacuum. But it's easy, especially when you're young, to say, "Oh, what I want is to be happy." And that's an elusive. I mean, that's like trying to catch smoke. I mean,
but that's a pretty good place to start, you know. And I talk in the book about happiness is achievable and is sustainable. And happiness is the pursuit of happiness in the sense that we kind of know what we'd like more of in our lives, and we spend time trying to have more of that in our lives.
Yeah.
And that could be, I talk about control as a very tangible thing. It doesn't really involve money. Usually involves saying no to things. Usually involves reorganizing our diary and getting control over our own diary and just doing more things that we want to do, whether that's a walk in the park or whether it's spending time with particular friends or family that we want to spend more time with, and saying no to other stuff. And that's a liberating realization, and it's available to all of us.
Well, interesting. I would argue that some people don't actually know what would make them happy. They think they do. They just haven't ever had time to pursue it. And then when they pursue it, it doesn't make them happy. They get bored of that too. Anyway, I think that that's a path you got to go down of trying the things that you think are going to work, and then they don't work. But you better learn from those lessons. And if you're continually picking the wrong things, well, then maybe step back and kind of reevaluate the whole, how are you picking these things? Why did you think that these things would make you happy and they turn out not to? And maybe it's a journey versus the destination thing.
And you know, if people achieve one level of success, then, you know, there's the next challenge and so on and so forth. And a common conversation I have with people is, you know, I don't get the lucky breaks, or this didn't work out for me, or that didn't work out for me. So I spend the first 7 chapters in the book talking about skills you might acquire to overcome challenge, and there's mostly mindset skills. But one chapter in particular, is about making more luck in your lives, creating luck, which sounds like a misnomer. How do you create more luck? Is luck? Well, when we talk about luck, we talk about opportunity, and there are things we can do to create opportunity. And one of the big things we can do is to prepare for opportunity. So to be ready to pounce when opportunity does present itself. And I tell the story in the book about a 10-year-old girl who's now the principal of a local school here. And she told me the story in passing, and I ended up writing about it in the book. When her and her sister in 1983 in Belfast, which was a very troubled city at the time, they were very poor, and didn't have a lot of money, but she spotted this bicycle in the window. You know, and it was something her family could never afford it. And that bicycle is a metaphor for a lot of things in life, because there are things that we think we could never have. I could never have that. How could I ever get there? But she didn't think that way. At 10 years old, she immediately wanted it and set about getting it. And how she did that, did it in a very remarkable way, and something, again, we can all learn from. The bike was actually being raffled. And to enter the raffle, you had the shop in the store, as they say in America. But uniquely, there was like a till where you paid for the groceries or whatever. And then there was a packing area. And each person who shopped there would get a little form to fill out. And they had to complete the sentence, shop at Crazy Prices, because Crazy Prices was the store. And a lot of people were too busy, you know, to do it. So they'd bring their shopping over to the packing area and leave them behind them. And she spotted this. So good observational skills. Then her and her sister, who was only 8 at the time, spent their summer filling out these forms. Used to do 20-odd forms a day, thinking of a new phrase to add for these discarded leaflets. And they had to be quick, because they'd be mopped up and, you know, by the store and given to new customers. And there's a lot in that in terms of life, in my opinion. One is observation skills to see it. 2, the neck to do it, you know, because she could have been told off, kicked out of the shop. She wasn't shopping there. 3, the perseverance. So this was 2 miles from her house. She used to walk there every day with her sister, which wasn't, you know, an 8 and 10-year-old walking around Belfast, you know, which in 1983 was not ideal. But she did that every day during the summer. And at the end of it all, they did the draw, and she won the bicycle. And she did that because she showed up. And a lot of life is showing up. And we don't always see immediate results. We don't always see quick wins. But for her, she was doing all the right things to position herself for the opportunity to win that bicycle. And I just thought, wow, that we can all learn a lot from that. You know, so there's a way of creating luck in that sense.
That's great. There's an old Branch Rickey quote that says something like, luck favors the prepared, or something like that. So totally. Yeah.
In the book, the phrase I use is luck doesn't waste time. Opportunity doesn't waste time with the unprepared.
Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm. So that rings a bell. I think that you'd said something about that. Yeah, we need to have at least a vague notion of our purpose to give us some motivation and some direction for, you know, how we want to, you know, move our lives forward. But you can't do anything about the past, and you can't really do anything about the future other than what you can do today. So what are you going to do today? Carpe diem, right? Seize the day. Make everything, make the most of what you can affect.
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. I mean, we spoke about this off air in terms of time increments. You know, if you get out the measuring tape and you go, okay, well, the life expectancy for a woman is a little bit longer, men a little bit shorter, maybe it's late 70s, maybe it's 80, you know, at best, whatever, or average, who knows. People kind of accept that and go, okay, well, you know, I'm late 40s now, you know, I'll do a quick calculation, I've got this amount of time left, etc. But is that really the way to approach things when it comes to purpose and getting the most out of life? Probably not. There's a lot of research gone into our perception of time. And this is what really interests me. And I talk about it in the book, in the chapter Purpose, where we have a perception of how long things take. And you know, I entered into this discussion, and there's a couple of interviews I did on this, where one guy went traveling for 16 months on a bicycle, you know, around South America, and came back, and he felt that he'd lived maybe 5 years of experience, and he came back, and his friends who had been there doing the normal 9 to 5, and just figured that he'd be gone for a couple of months. They didn't really find that time passing at all. But he met new people and, you know, learned new languages and had adventures and fell off his bike and got back on again and all that stuff on a daily basis, and really knocked himself out of his routine. And our brains love routine. They love, it saves on resources, brain power, if we can just, you know, not challenge ourselves and focus on our kind of programmed norms. But once we get knocked out of that, we really start to engage our senses and really start to kind of live, as I describe it in the book, live broader and deeper each day. And if we can do a little bit more of that, we may not have lived longer in terms of time increments, but we certainly will have lived richer. And that certainly is a worthwhile goal in terms of whatever it might look like for you.
Wow. Okay, my mind is spinning here. Let's come back to this, you know, richer, deeper thinking in terms of like area under the curve, or having a bigger life experience as opposed to just merely longer.
Yeah.
A long, shallow, purposeless life could not possibly be as good as a bigger life, and a big one that lasted a long time. Why, that's the best of all worlds. But I want to come back to that, because what first occurred to me while you were talking is that who hasn't experienced this terrible feeling of feeling like time has flown by? What have I done, you know, in the last few years? When I was not much younger, I lived in a place where the facilitated this, and I, you know, I was always doing, you know, scary, adventurous things, and my life was rich, full of these powerful experiences. But more recently, I have moved, and so while I am much, I'm going to say, fitter in sort of a modern sense, right? You know, I look better in the mirror. My VO2 max is probably better. You know, stuff like that. It's all gym and track and exercise based, not adventure based. And so when I think back to all the things that I did to get to this level of fitness, I could barely think of it. It's like, what did I do? What have I been doing? And so there's something to this terrible feeling of time flying by that is a sign that you're not doing it right. Is that right? Do you think that?
I think so. You know, it was an interesting movie many years ago called Yes Man with Jim Carrey. I don't know if you
remember,
where he had to say yes to everything. That's a fun concept.
That's a powerful way to live.
Yeah, that's a fun concept. You may have taken an 11 or two too far. But there's something in that, isn't there? I mean, there's always, we talked about opportunity in one sense earlier, an opportunity to capitalize on, you know, on something for ourselves, an objective. But there's also every opportunity to live a richer life every day, isn't there? People ask us to do stuff all the time, you know, stuff that's, I'll do that again. I'll get back to you on that. I might not be able to fit it in, whatever else, you know. But I think certainly, just my personal opinion, I think that adventure is better had together. It's better to do group stuff, in my opinion. Mm. And I talk a lot about it in the book in terms of, you know, success is not real unless shared. What is it out there on your own doing stuff and running on the treadmill in the gym, you know? It's better to sit in front of the TV for sure. But is there a better way? I love the kind of communal group stuff where we all go on an adventure together and learn something from each other as well as from the experience. You
know? To echo that, I'll say that one of the things I have recently added is a men's group that gets together, and we do a boot camp every Saturday morning. And each member takes a turn, leading the group. And it's free. It's, you know, there's like, you don't have to sign up. You just show up.
Wow.
And then they proceed to kick each other's ass in this boot camp, which, you know, I just bragged about how fit I was. While I started doing this boot camp, I was dying. I totally was not fit in lots of different ways. And that's probably because it was all gym stuff, not out in the world where everything can happen and does. And you experience that and have to prepare for that. Well, anyway, one of the things that is really nice about this that I didn't expect, I didn't sign up for it for this, but it's a benefit I'm getting, is that there's a camaraderie where everybody is helping each other. You know, one of the things they say is, no man is left behind, but you also leave no man where he was. So,
I like that.
You know, everybody's got their own level of fitness, and some of the guys are slower than others. And we wait, and we encourage, and we stay together, you know, when we're running up hills and stuff like that. And you know, and at the end, maybe I didn't get the best workout I could have because I was having to wait and talk and encourage people. But in the end, it's a better experience. It's more memorable than my perfect workout would have been. So yeah, you know, when I in preparation for our chat here, I looked up the definition of spirituality, you know, because people love to talk about how, you know, they're spiritual, but not religious. And I thought, well, what does that even mean, spiritual? I'm not even sure what that means exactly. I think I know what it means. I say it too sometimes. But here's the first part of the definition, connection. A feeling of being linked to a higher power or to nature or to the collective human experience. So being with people, that's what you're saying. That's a part of a spiritual experience.
I think that's really important. You know, and somebody put it another way recently. And somebody said, well, you know, you've got all these religions, you know. Said, but it's a bit like the lyrics to a song and the music. You know, the music is this connection that we have with each other. Whereas the lyrics are just everybody's interpretation of that. All these different religions are just different lyrics. But the music we know to be true. Which I thought that was interesting.
I like that. I think that when people want to argue this religion or that religion or this way of thinking is the right one, then I think they've lost the track. The better part is to try to move forward and do it with other people and make a connection and build powerful memories in whatever way serves you, whether it's getting back to being the musician you always wish you could have been, but your mom said you'd never make any money doing that. Or, you know, me getting to be the athlete that I always wanted to be, and maybe I don't get to go to the Olympics. Okay, well, you know, I can still feel good in my body and pleased with my ability to, you know, function, you know, like I did when I was younger. So there's lots of ways to do it, you know, to enjoy the music. And then the lyrics don't matter that much.
Absolutely. It's funny enough, today, coming over here to do this call, we heard in the news, you may not have heard it over there yet, that a very well-known soccer player was killed in a car crash this morning for Liverpool, Diego Jota, 28. And, you know, apparently, now obviously this is out of the press stuff, his tire blew out when he was just overtaking somebody, and himself and his brother were killed on the motorway in Spain. And, you know, there's a guy, he was only married 10 days ago. He's 28 years old. He's somebody said, you know, there's a guy that's, he's won life's lottery. He's played, he's a, you know, he's a senior international for Portugal, played 49 times for Portugal. I'm just looking up his profile there. 123 times for Liverpool, scored 49 goals for Portugal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, when you talk about sacrifice, doing what you love, and they said, well, listen, he always played with a smile on his face. You know, it was what he loved doing. And so, I mean, it's, you know, to pay tribute, it's not about the increments of time. It's about how we live our lives in that rich, deep way. We're willing to sacrifice to get it, what we think is worthwhile, and how we make that calculation. And I just think there's a guy, you know, that we should all kind of pay attention to that event, because that can happen anyways, unfortunately. And obviously he was a role model in so many ways for what we can do with the short life, you know.
Well, and who hasn't had friends, even close ones, who get cancer and they are gone, and, you know, or accidents like you're describing? There's a movement happening that's been happening for a little while. I've been sort of nibbling around the edges of it, of this idea that there's a new phase of life being added to our childhood, teenager, adulthood, and then you decline and die. But there's a new phase of life that's being added, which is sort of like post-retirement, but you're not ready to die yet. You know, what are you going to do with yourself? And,
yeah.
You know, and people are having to like go back to school to learn all the life skills, you know, how to start again. What do I want to do? I don't even know what I want to do. You know, I've been so busy being this important person, you know, and now I have to give that up. I'm afraid of retiring and dying, but mostly I'm afraid of retiring because who am I going to be if I can't be the CEO anymore? You know, and even Wise Athletes is kind of, you know, you don't have to be retired. I'm not retired, but you're kind of getting, you know, maybe your kids are out or almost out. And anyway, you're nearing this last phase, this new phase, the new old age. But, you know, if I were younger, I would say, don't wait for that. You have no idea what's waiting for you around the corner. Mm-hmm. Make your life important. As soon as you think of it, you should try to find what is that going to make your life satisfying and do as much of that as you can, you know, say no to some of the things that are lower on the priority so you can say yes to the things that are really going to make a difference.
Yeah.
And in the pattern of saying yes more, Jim Carrey. I have had recently a audience member invite me to go on an adventure. I don't even know this guy. I mean, I've chatted with him online, but I really don't even know this guy. And he invited me to join him and some of his friends on a trip to Japan to go climb Mount Fuji. Well, this is nuts. Why would I accept that? I said yes. And I, let me tell you, it's been the biggest pain in my ass trying to get this arranged and figure out how can I get from here to there, and with the right stuff. And in a moment of inspiration, it occurred to me to welcome that challenge, not complain about it, but to enjoy it, embrace it. How often do we really get to struggle and struggle over something that's going to be wonderful in the end? So anyway, I said yes.
Wow. That's a great example. Let us know how that goes.
I certainly will.
Look forward to hearing about that. And, you know, and you talk, you know, getting back to another subject, we're going over back here a little bit, apologies for that, but the group stuff is very interesting.
Yeah.
Because I do write about it in the book about Nelson Mandela, you know, and Robben Island, and for listeners that will be somewhat familiar with that. A lot has been written about Nelson Mandela, rightly so, and a movie made about him, Invictus. But reading his autobiography, he talks about his time in Robben Island. You know, he was 18 years there in a very small prison cell, and how the camaraderie between his fellow prisoners got him through that, because they had this overarching purpose, and that overarching purpose was, of course, to free South Africa from apartheid, a country of 48 million odd people. And with that higher purpose, it bound them together as a group. And I also talk in the book about, we brought a group of elite athletes to an army training camp last year in Ireland, and this is where they train new recruits. You know, so it was all the stuff, carry bags, and, you know, crawl through the mud and into the freezing sea and all the rest. In February, Irish seas in February aren't very hospitable.
I bet.
And you know, but after he got out of prison, he was in remarkably good health for all he'd been through, you know, all the hard labor, all that stuff. And he had a very interesting interview with Bill Clinton, you know, and I think that this is another subject which I think is really worth mentioning. And Bill Clinton met with him, and he recounts the story. Bill Clinton does. He says, how did you put, you know, these government members back in place, these people that put you in prison, that kept you in prison, you know? And he said, well, I knew if I continued with hate in my heart, I could never truly be free. And I thought that was such a powerful statement, because sometimes we also need to put things down to live our lives fully, you know, and carrying hate and bias and racism, they're all isms, you know, terrorism, They're all baggage, aren't they? They all clog our minds with emotion and a skewed perspective on things. And the more of that nonsense we can actually start to put down one by one, I think the more of a chance we also have of getting closer to our real purpose in life and also really starting to live.
Interesting. Yeah, I read something recently that said anger is the poison we drink to punish somebody else who has screwed up.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, something like that. That doesn't actually sound like it was right, but that's the idea. It's like, you know, why are you the one suffering when they're the ones who screwed up?
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of camaraderie that Mandela experienced in prison, is, you know, to a much lesser extent, it's a little bit like the boot camp you're describing. And also the army commandant who was putting these athletes through this rigorous training session, because he said to me, you know, Adrian, sometimes we need a little bit of hardship in our lives. Sometimes we need to suffer together to create that bond. And that's a very powerful source of motivation and collegiality. And in Robben Island, all these political prisoners were put in one place for a reason. They didn't want them polluting the rest of the prison system with their ideas. Mm-hmm. But that kind of backfired because it was a bit like the army. They do this to new recruits to galvanize them. You know, it's us against them. And they very much made it us against them. But they then pressured these fractured factions of anti-apartheid struggle all in one prison. And they all bound together and come out the other end much stronger. And Mandela lived until the age of 95. He was very mentally strong and quite physically robust. And I talk about the average age he might have lived to. His life expectation out of prison was probably 50-something, if he'd never been to prison, just as a black South African. Mm. And in a normal prison system, you might have been less than that. There's a guy who lived in 95, quite a healthy life. So we have a robustness about us if we can tap into, I think, an overarching purpose, and also start to connect and work together as a human race.
Right. Yeah. My mind goes back to when I was doing it right, when I was having my adventures regularly, you know, every week or two. It was, of course, almost always with somebody. Mm. You know, one person, you know, my best friend Brian is probably who it was, but it wasn't always Brian or only just Brian. But having other people made a difference. It was also safer, you know, probably that's why we did it that way. But it turned out that was more meaningful. But the other thing that was always a part of it was suffering. Mm. It was always hard. You were always glad it was over, because you were at the end of your rope. You know, you had exhausted all of your mental and physical energy to survive and get back to the car. And you were glad it was over, but I always felt a tremendous peace, a personal contentment in me. You know, for a while, it didn't last, but for a while, I just felt like I had done all I could do. That's enough.
I think we all have these hidden depths to face challenge that we don't probably access on a daily basis. And, you know, we also talked off air about, you know, your ability to access courage, resourcefulness, push through pain, push through tiredness. And we you know, for, you know, whatever, the last thousands of years, as you know, as we develop as Homo sapiens, we've developed these skills that we probably don't use enough. And if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's the part of the draw to athletics, isn't it? Because we need that challenge in life. That's how we're designed. And we're misusing our kind of physiological gifts if we don't take on these challenges, at least to some extent, in order to enhance our God-given skills, you know?
Yeah, I had tried to codify once a formula for how to figure out how to design the perfect amount of suffering in an adventure. And what I came, you know, because okay. if you do it rationally, you're going to pick something that's well under what you're capable of doing, because what you want 100% chance of success. But, you know, you get back from something where you had 100% chance of success, you don't get that total satisfaction from it. So how, but if you pick something that's too hard and you fail, well, you also don't get that total satisfaction from it. And so what I had resolved was that my best adventures were the ones where, with an optimistic attitude, I felt like I probably could succeed. I could, you know, and I'm not talking about dying or not. I mean, getting to the objective destination and back before dark or before some problem happened. But of course, optimistic meant wrong. And that would mean that it was a little too hard, but pushing through that last little bit. So, right, it's that last rep of the set. It's that last little bit of the adventure that makes it a tremendous success or not.
It is. And there's been a lot of research done in terms of challenge, you know, the right level of challenge, for example, to train athletes with. You know, because if it's too much challenge, to become overwhelmed and demotivated. Too little challenge, they're not pushing themselves into that challenge state beyond their comfort zones. And I think they settled on, I could be wrong now, but they settled on something between 70% and 85% success rate. If you can, you know, if whatever you're doing, there should be probably more than a 50% chance of succeeding. But, you know, success should never be, it should never be guaranteed. I mean, you're going to have to work for it and push yourself. And, and, you know, dig deep and draw on those resources to achieve it. And that's how we grow.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, whether your fear of failure, you know, can come in lots of forms, but that's a important, that's an important driver for the, you know, the kind of person I want to be. I want to be a person who confronts my challenges and works as hard as I can to overcome them. And if I fail, well, it was just too hard, but it wasn't because I gave up.
Yeah. I mean, there's a nobleness in failure sometimes, isn't there? I mean, I did all the right things and just, you know, I fell at the last hurdle, but I wouldn't change it.
Yeah.
You know, there's something to be said for that in life.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be afraid to fail. That's just something that's the wrong message to people.
Right. Yeah. If you're picking things where you're not going to fail, then you're not trying, then you don't have to try hard enough. That's just a clue that you're not picking things that are hard enough if you never fail.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. You know, and you know, it's back to this catalyst, isn't it? You know, that's a catalyst for getting the best out of ourselves. And something else to talk about in the book was Marcus McGee, who's a local musician here in Ireland, a great guy, who was diagnosed with cancer, stage 4 cancer, out of the blue. This is a guy in his early 40s, young kids, and it's stage 4 cancer all of a sudden, and it was a catalyst, a huge catalyst for change in his life. And I do a podcast episode on this. He's in the book. And he talks about things he never would have done only for that cancer diagnosis. That he saw it as a positive catalyst in his life. And he, thankfully, he's stable now. He's clear scans, all that great stuff. And thank God, long may it continue. But he's an interesting case study, because we shouldn't need a cancer diagnosis in our lives to start getting the best out of ourselves, to start reevaluating what's important to us, to start planning, start acting, asking ourselves, what can I do about that today? And what am I going to do about it today, more importantly?
Well, as we wrap up, let's get into this how to have a bigger life bit. What do you advise people in terms of a process to try to get this, not just a longer life, but a bigger life, a life that is more meaningful, more satisfying? I have always had this idea that when I get to my time, that I will be ready, that I will feel like I've done what I came to do, and it was a lot, and it would be like that feeling at the end of an adventure that I just barely succeeded in surviving, but I stood on top of that mountain, and I made it, and I'm totally satisfied. That's the feeling I want on my last day.
Mm, what would I advise? Well, it's a very individual question we have to ask ourselves. But I suppose there's two things that jump out when you ask me that question. One is, I talk about the analogy of the river. I don't talk about it in the book, but on the podcast with Marcus. You know, a river, it runs deeper in parts, broader in parts. But, you know, it runs a particular length. And at different junctures, a bit like, you know, the flow of our lives, we have the opportunity to slow down, just like a river does, to live deeper and broader, just like a river does, to, you know, maybe I'm pushing this metaphor a little bit. And then there are times in our lives when we don't have that opportunity, and maybe we have to run a little faster with life because that's what life demands of us. But in terms of our capacity, we usually live well below our capacity. You're an athlete. When you talk about fatigue, there's a well-known professional athlete called David Gillick from Ireland. And I watched the podcast recently for him, and he was 1800 or 1500, whatever his distance was. And he said, but you know, when you hit that point of exhaustion, I might be paraphrasing this now incorrectly, he said, that's a sensation. It's not a limit. And our limits are usually a long way beyond that. Usually you're probably at about 40% of what you can do. You start to feel fatigue. And once we realize that, we can start to push beyond that. And there was another athlete who I'm sure you're familiar with, Alberto Salazar. Mm. He was a controversial coach also. But he used to be credited with being able to get that bit more out of himself compared to other athletes. You know, he'd get that 98, 99% out of him, whatever people were pushing themselves to 90% or 95%. And as a result, you know, without the technology of the day, the runners, the nutrition, all that stuff, he was running marathons in 2:08. You know, but after he won the Boston Marathon, one of those marathons, he was legally declared dead. You know, but they revived him. You know, gave him his prize. So you know, our capacity is a long way past what we probably think it is. And if we start to realize that, and even in small ways, ask more. My coaching company is called Ask More, and it says, "Ask more what? Ask more of yourself. Ask more of life." That's the message I'd give people. You know. And how we ask more of ourselves is a very personal question. Really, that's for the listener to answer. But they'll know the answer to that. They'll know it. Whether they're willing to face it or not is the question. And do it. Do something about it. Oh. That takes courage. But I would certainly you know, I'd like to encourage people to ask themselves that and also face up to that challenge. And you know, I don't think you'll ever regret it. You know, doing more for yourself and others, of course. I mean, back to that, you know, it's a team sport. Life's a team sport, and it's what we can do for others is so important to the holistic benefit to ourselves ultimately.
Right, that's great. That's really good advice. And the last little bit is really important to me more now than ever. But you know, achievement. Individual achievement is sort of what we grew up being taught, you know, good grades in school and meritocracy, all of that. But really, the spirituality, the fulfillment in life comes from serving others. And so, you know, how do we do that to have these full lives that we want? Anyway, that's really great.
And the final point I make on that show, and one I touched on earlier, is what can we put things down that are getting in the way?
Yeah. Because you've only got so much time. You have 24 hours and 365 days in a year, and you got to spend that wisely.
Yeah. And including the hate, the racism, and all that stuff. You know, you're carrying all this on your back. Right? Just start putting some of that stuff down and get on with living your life in a positive way and make it positive for others. And I don't think we go too far wrong.
Great. Fantastic. Adrian. Wow. Thank you very much. Delighted. Tell our audience how they can find you, your book.
Yeah. So if you just Google The Success Complex, you'll see it hopefully all over the internet. It's on Amazon. It's on many other book outlets, resellers, et cetera, et cetera. And listen, I'd love people to read it. I think they get a lot out of it. And it takes people on a worthwhile journey. It's also on Audible as well for people that are too busy to read books and want to listen to it in their car. That's me sometimes. And I have an accompanying Spotify as well, a podcast, 3 episodes on the book, where I interview someone from the book, which is well worth a listen, particularly that podcast on purpose with Marcus McGee.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for that. And I'll say that the book is organized very well. It's in chapters that stand alone, as well as all fit into the theme. So it's an easy book to digest. It's very well written. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. And I appreciate your time.
Yeah. Glad hey, have a great one. So, what's the weather like in Ireland?
Yeah, it's rainy at the moment, 20 degrees, as we say, Celsius here.
All right.
Rainy, surprise. Well, good luck in Japan. I really look forward to hearing about that. Yeah. And well done. It sounds like a great challenge.
I hope so. All right. Thanks a bunch. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Adrian Kelly. You can find more information about Adrian and his book in the show notes.